Welcome, everyone. So obviously, Venerable Children is not back yet. She's in Europe, and I think she's in Germany at this time. And she's scheduled to return next week to the Abbey around, I don't know, midnight. So she won't be leading next week, but she'll be teaching May 8th with all of our hopes on that one. So why don't we begin by just sitting quietly for a moment? And then I'll set a motivation, then we'll begin the review. For the motivation tonight, I'm going to share something from Volume 4, written by His Holiness and Venerable Children. In the chapters on the higher training and concentration, we have learned of the astounding abilities that sincere meditators can develop. We may wonder why they are explained to those of us who are beginners. Won't some people be discouraged by their own comparatively feeble concentration when they see how far they have to go? Well, this depends on our perspective. Learning about the capacities of the human mind inspires us. We know that if we put in the same time and effort as past meditators have, that we too can actualize abilities like theirs. In addition, knowing that there are Buddhist meditators who have already attained these abilities gives us a better idea of the Sangha that is our object of refuge. This allows us to cultivate faith and respect in them. And as a side benefit, if we have the tendency towards spiritual arrogance, learning of these advanced practices checks our pride, suppressing that hindrance to spiritual progress. End of quote. So we have this opportunity tonight to review some material that Venerable Chodron has gone over in great detail, as she always does. And just to see the beautiful aspects of our mind that we can cultivate, the vastness that is there waiting for us to develop over a long time, of course. And if anything, reviewing this material should really inspire our practice and gladden our heart that these incredible states of mind are absolutely available to every single person who engages with the teachings, who engages diligently with, you know, daily meditation practice, with an authentic spiritual teacher. And then we just keep our mind and heart focused on full awakening. Doesn't matter how long it takes. And at that point, when we become fully awakened, we can truly do what we want to do right now in our heart and mind. And that's to be of benefit to every living being that we encounter. So the material that we're going to go over tonight is not as challenging as the past weeks. It's not so technically demanding, and so it's like a breath of fresh air. This is not something that's difficult to understand. Accomplishing it is another thing, but it really is really, we can think of this as going on a beautiful journey with His Holiness and Venerable Chodron as being the tour guides through this journey tonight. So I thought it would be kind of fun, well, fun in my mind, maybe not for you, if I started the whole evening with an example of the Buddha being pressured and pressured and pressured to perform miracles. This was just an ongoing thing in his experience once people figured out that he was the awakened one. And you'll recognize this story, but I just love this because the Buddha has a fantastic sense of humor that you'll remember from this story. So I'm not going to tell you the story yet. You'll know what it is in a minute. So the Buddha was staying with hundreds of fully ordained monks in the bamboo grove outside of Rajgir. King Bimbisara ruled that region, and he was one of the Buddha's greatest patrons. The king led many of his subjects to practice the Buddha's teachings. Six heretical teachers, leaders of the Madhadhara ascetics, were also staying at Rajgir, and the king's younger brother followed their teachings. Their misguided ways had clouded his mind. The king, wishing to help his brother, suggested that he should listen to the Buddha. Although he saw no reason to, the younger respected the king, and in deference to his brother, he decided to offer a great feast attended by his six teachers and their entourage, along with the Buddha and an assembly of monastics. So the six ascetic teachers came and sat in the highest seats. The Buddha and his disciples also attended, and when they arrived, they walked toward the few remaining seats. But before they could reach those seats, the six teachers found themselves getting up from the highest seats and taking the lower. They tried three times to take the highest seats, but each time found themselves in the lower seats. Finally, feeling ashamed, they remained there. It gets better. Before the food was served, water was brought to the guests so that they could wash their hands. As Buddha was in the highest seat, his host offered the water to him first, but he said, "Oh, please, offer first to your teachers." The water was then offered to them, but when the vessel was tipped, nothing flowed into their hands. The host tried again and again, but still the water would not flow. He then offered again to the Buddha. The water flowed freely to the Buddha, and after that to everyone. Before they ate, the host asked the Buddha to bless the food. He deferred again to the six teachers, saying, "Oh, please, would you please request the blessing from your own teachers?" But when the six teachers tried to pray, they were unable to utter a word and gestured that the Buddha should say the blessing. The Buddha did so with a clear, beautiful voice. The food was offered first to the Buddha, but he said once more, "Oh, please, offer it first to your teachers." The food was then offered to them, but everything they tried to take flew in the air. After that, the Buddha took food and everything then came down into their hands. After the meal, the host made the customary request to the Buddha for teaching, and the Buddha again deferred to the six, saying, "Have your teachers speak of their doctrines." Again, the six teachers, unable to speak a word, could only motion for the Buddha to speak. The Buddha spoke in a beautiful voice, and each listener heard what fitted their own needs, deepening their understanding, bringing realizations, and winning followers. The six teachers were pretty humiliated now, and they were really angry, and they went away to recruit demons to help them out. The demons then manifested as the six teachers going to the marketplace to show miraculous feats and preach against the Buddha. The people were impressed. In the public square before their rapt audience, the demons challenged the Buddha to a competition of miraculous powers. They boasted that they could outdo everything the Buddha did 2-1. "People will see for themselves who's more powerful," they proclaimed. The six teachers went to King Bimbisara and asked him to deliver their challenge to the Buddha. The king just laughed at their arrogance. "You fools! Your miraculous deeds can't begin to compare to those of the Buddha's. Your challenge is like the light of a firefly compared with the sunlight, like the water in an ox's hoof print compared to the ocean. It's like the fox challenging the lion." The six pundits persisted and said, "You'll see. What happened before, there's no indication of what will happen now. When we compete, it will be clear who is the greater." King Bimbisara visited the Buddha and told him of the challenge. And the Buddha simply replied, "Well, okay, the time is now. Prepare a suitable place." And so from then, we go on to the story of
the Days of Miracles.
Right, and you can read that on our website. So throughout all the early scriptures, we see that the Buddha didn't like to show his miraculous powers. This is the point of this story. And no matter how many times he was confronted with people saying this, he often refused until he saw that it was the time was right for these particular beings. And so the Buddha's powers during the miracle days were more magnificent than those of the non-Buddhists. And as a result, all the non-Buddhist ascetics became the Buddha's disciples. So, you ever think you have problems? You know, our problems, of course, the Buddha's very quick to handle everything that came at him, but he was constantly getting people making these kinds of comments and challenging him to show his powers. So when studying the super knowledges, His Holiness talks about the consciousness. And what I love about this section of the book is that Venerable and His Holiness just weave us in slowly, getting us primed to hear about what the six knowledges are, the six super knowledges. So when he talks about the consciousness, His Holiness says the consciousness's ability is to perceive objects. And what we're trying to do in spiritual practice is clear away all the impediments to spiritual practice. So material things are impediments. For example, I can't see what's on the other side of this wall or that wall. I can't see in the distance. I can't see what's going on in Spokane right now. I can't see what's happened in the past. I can't see what's coming in the future. And so my mind is obscured. The ordinary mind's obscured. It's also obscured by karmic obscurations. And because of negative karma, our ability to perceive or understand what we're seeing and perceiving with our senses is limited. Afflictive obscurations obscure us from seeing emptiness and from realizing nirvana. Cognitive obscurations interfere with us perceiving all phenomena that exist. But the very nature of our mind, as we know, is it's clear and knowing. It can reflect objects. Knowing or cognizant means it can grasp or understand objects. That's the nature of the mind. It's already there. So our job is to clear away all this rubbish that's covering it. And this is advice from Venerable. As we hear teachings about the super knowledges, be aware that actualizing these are steps in clearing away these different kinds of obscurations. So the principal aim of the Buddhist teachings is to stop dukkha by stopping rebirth under the influence of ignorance, afflictions, and karma, and to attain nirvana or full awakening. That's the principal aim of Buddhism. Nevertheless, there's many scriptures that present other spiritual accomplishments that are valued as well. Nirvana, full awakening, is the principal one, but there are other accomplishments that the Buddha taught. And the first of these is mastery over the various dimensions of the mind, the dhyanas and the formless absorptions that are accomplished by means of samadhi. Spiritual accomplishment praised in the scriptures includes the super knowledges. And these are supernormal physical and mental powers through which meditators can perform feats that ordinary people consider miraculous or miraculous because they can't be explained by either science of old or modern day science. And science, as we know it, is really still dealing with the external physical world and the biological beings in it and the chemical reactions in the world. So science isn't studying the mind, which is a whole different realm of gaining understanding and perceptions. So we tend to say that something is a miracle when it's a physical thing. And usually we say that when we don't understand what the causes are. So before encountering the Buddhist teachings, we tend to think that miracles happen without causes. And as we know, that's simply not the case. There's always causes. They can't arise. Things can't arise without causes. And that's just the nature of impermanent functioning things. So I'm sure that before you met the Dharma, you probably had experiences or you read about things that you called miracles. And I'm wondering if anyone would like to share what you used to call or refer to as a miracle and how you think of it now. Ramadeki.
This actually just popped in my head when you were talking, but my grandma was Christian Scientist, and every Wednesday sometimes I'd visit her in the summertime, every Wednesday they would go and talk about their healing miracles, I guess. And I remember one lady sharing a story where she had accidentally, I think, hit her face with the car door or something, like really slammed it, but she intentionally didn't look in the mirror because their belief is kind of denying that things happen or like that there's no sickness and no injury. But she said because she didn't look in the mirror after a couple of days, it totally was fine and went away. So, and I think in their belief system, that was an example of a miracle or the healing. But
I was in my 20s. I lived in Idaho and I had a 1968 Ford Fairlane. and I was driving from Sandpoint home in early spring, and I hit an icy patch. The pin on the steering wheel column went off, and so I was going around this corner with the sunny ice, and I was going in 360 spins, and the wheel was just going around and around. There's a 25-foot embankment with the train tracks and a mountain on this side. It went around about three or four times, and I hit the ditch, and about 10 seconds later, a fully loaded logging truck came down. And I missed, you know, that was, yeah, I never forget that moment. But it was one of those things that anything could have happened. And I just sat in my car in the ditch as he drove by with this two double load of logs about 10 seconds after I hit that ditch.
Wow. Yeah, that's good. So you didn't have the karma to die that day. Yeah, up to. Well, I'll share one story that you've heard me tell before, but when Robert, the stucco guy, came to check on the stucco the last time he was here, and we were walking around the building, and he'd been here for months and months and months the previous year, he just looked at me and he said, "You know what? I got to tell you, this place is a miracle." And so, you know, we know what he means, right? Northeast Washington State, outside of the town of Newport, there's a whole bunch of people wearing robes with very short haircuts. And people from around the world are coming to this place. And if we go back and back, and then there's this nun by the name of Venerable Thupten Children, who's one of the causes and conditions for this incredible thing to happen here. And, you know, until we're Buddhas, we won't know all the causes and conditions that have come together for this to be happening here, and how long ago, which lifetime she got the idea. She's been creating merit for many, many lifetimes for this to happen. And so, yes, I can see why Robert would say, many people say, this is a miracle that this place is happening. And we might even say, those of us in this room, it's a miracle that I'm a Buddhist, or it's a miracle I'm ordained. But there are causes and conditions, and we know some of them, and eventually we'll know all of them down the road. Okay, yes, Venerable Damsel.
I didn't grow up in any kind of a faith, and actually it was when I first met the Buddha, met the Dharma, a certain number of things happened that were to me like inexplicable, and, you know, we would say force of past life prayer or whatever. It was the first time anything kind of quote metaphysical happened to me, and I was just, you know. But what I loved most was when I told like one of my Buddhist meditation teacher about this. He just said, "You know, Buddhism is not about these like spiritual experiences. You know, that's not why you came to practice." And I was like, "Oh, I'm interested in ordaining." He's like, "You can't ordain based on a spiritual feeling." He said, "This is a logical process. You need to go study and meditate and learn the teachings. Then you make a logical decision." Everybody was telling me that. And I really appreciate that about everyone I met in the Dharma.
That's fantastic advice. I think we need that exact wording on the website. So just for fun, I'm going to show you something with the help of Venerable Puntsok. So don't hit the play button yet, Venerable Puntsok. So this was just filmed the other day with a regular old iPad. There's no AI enhancement done here. There's no strings attached. There's nothing going on. This is just raw footage of what Venerable Rinchen and Venerable Monlam, were you there? And myself saw that you might call a miracle. There's no sound. I hope the people online can see this. Upeka, the cat in the frame, was just like, "What?" Okay. All right. So the causes and conditions for that weren't magic. It wasn't a miracle. It was one of her little kitties called Karuna, and Venerable Rinchen put her underneath a box so that she wouldn't run outside while she was taking plants in and out. Anyway, we'll take the show on the road. Yes, this went on for a little bit too long, actually. So super knowledges don't pop out of nowhere. They involve training to do them. And here's the really important point here that Venerable Chodron and His Holiness keep saying over and over and over again. They are a byproduct of samadhi. And these give meditators these access to hidden laws in the material world that can only be known through refined states of meditative absorption. So like the mastery of the dimensions of the mind, the super knowledges can be attained by non-Buddhists. They can. And while some spiritual seekers hold them as the purpose of the path, some people might be setting out just to get these super knowledges. But in our training, the Buddha sees them as a byproduct of concentration. So we may, you know, even get the idea, maybe this is down the road, and this is why we have to keep hearing these teachings again and again. They're a byproduct. We're doing this to benefit others. You know, at some point when we get some of these, or all of them, we may think, hey, I could be an influencer. I could get my own channel, and you know, I can make a lot of money. And I could have my own Zoom show where people just call in and get spiritual, well, not spiritual advice. I would just, you know, they want to hear stuff like a fortune teller. I could do that for them. You know, we could go that direction. And so the advice is that we really keep our intention clear. And this is mentioned again and again. So it's byproduct. And the Buddha emphasizes to his disciples that they should not be content with just attaining these various absorptions and supernormal abilities, because without the attainment of nirvana, they're still susceptible to all forms of samsara dukkha. So you can have clairvoyance, you can have psychic powers, but you're still in samsara. And here's the part that really gets my attention. When this life ends, you're going to be reborn according to whatever karma in your mind stream ripens at that time. So having those powers or not having them, guess what? They degenerate when we go through the death and rebirth process. That's the way it is. So it's just, you know, if you have samadhi in this life, it doesn't mean that we're going to come out of the room in the next life with samadhi. We're going to come out as a human being, still crying, still screaming, and doing all the things we do and having temper tantrums right up until age about 91. So the Buddha again and again emphasizes that we should not be content with attaining these high states of consciousness or with the supernormal abilities, because nirvana is our final goal. And then we're actually secure from dukkha. But before that, there's no security. All right. And then they also, you know, keep emphasizing the fact that these superpowers, these super knowledges, they are developed in that lifetime. And then if we are not checking our mind and our motivation and our intention, then some conceit can come with this power. And then you just get really distracted by all the people who are coming to you wanting to know this and wanting to know that. And so, of course, this is just great. So in the same way, though, the Buddhist scriptures can give us the information that we're seeking from a fortune teller, but it's more reliable in the form of teachings on karma. So we learn what is virtuous and what's non-virtuous in the format. And so you have to come and sit in a teaching and hear about karma and hear what are the 10 non-virtues and what are the 10 virtues. So instead of signing up for a Zoom call, which could be very expensive with a psychic, why not come to the Good Karma Retreat, a May long weekend, and you can continue studying that text. So we might have this, you know, pleading thought in our mind, you know, oh, I need to go and talk to someone who has some special abilities, because you know what? No one at the Abbey listens to me. They just don't listen to me. I think I'll just dial up, talk to a psychic. Well, you know, if you look at the passage from Good Karma, verse 22, verse 22 says this in response to no one listens to me. When everyone challenges what I say, it is the weapon of destructive karma turning upon me. For discarding integrity and consideration for others, from now on I will refrain from troubling behavior. So we experience situations where people don't believe us, or they lack confidence in us, or they doubt us, or they doubt our wisdom or our decisions, or how we're going to wash the dishes. And sometimes there's a good reason for this. Other times we may know what we're doing, but others question our recommendations. We may be in positions of responsibility, but everyone in our sphere of influence, they're constantly contradicting us and challenging our goals and plans and ways of enacting them. Anyone have that experience? No one listens to me. So seeing how lack of integrity and consideration for others has led to the karmic boomerang, our experiencing something similar to what we've caused, comes about. So studying the teachings on karma would be the way to go. Okay. So Venerable Chördön was describing a time when she was in Thailand, and the monks at that time told her that although the super knowledges are not a sign of insight or wisdom, the Buddhist texts do consider them a sign of spiritual accomplishment. So in the Buddha's time, many yogis had these abilities and would even challenge the Buddha, as we heard, in these contests of miraculous powers. So again, super knowledges are considered spiritual accomplishments because people work hard to get them in their meditation practice and to generate them. And they are accomplishments that ordinary people simply don't have. But again, it's not the attainment of nirvana. So I thought I'd read a passage from a book that a few of us are reading here at the present time. It's a really interesting book. It's called Footprints in the Dust. And it's written by Venerable Dhammika. And these stories are all stories that he gathered from doing research in the Pali scriptures. And it's really a very interesting insight into the Buddha's life. So here's one section that talks about what we're talking about at this present time. Someone once asked the Buddha to get one of his monks to demonstrate a superhuman ability, a psychic feat or a miracle, so that even more people would have faith in the Buddha. And the Buddha replied that there were such powers which thoughtful or skeptical people would have legitimate doubts about. There was, however, one such power that everyone could have confidence in. And what he called the psychic power or the miracle of Dharma instruction. This consisted, he said, of encouraging others to be observant, to think, to behave in certain ways, and to persist in doing it over a period of time. That is what is important. So the Buddha prohibited his followers from displaying these powers to show off. In fact, monastics who even speak truthfully about their supernormal powers transgress a pratimoksha precept. It's one of the lapses. And so why is it that we are prohibited from even speaking truthfully if we had superpowers? Why is that? Namo Jigme.
I think that people would be attached to wanting to do those things, and they wouldn't study. They would just have a very narrow focus on what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Venerable Pelge.
Because it's easy for people who have supernormal powers to use it not in a very righteous way. So they might use it to gain fame, to gain wealth, and then it distorts the whole Dharma world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Any other thoughts about this one? Venerable Chöni.
I think we've even seen this at some level, but no matter how advanced you are in your practice, the danger of becoming a superstar is lethal, really lethal. So to lose everything because you're adored for your powers is the way back out of your practice and into the hell realms, probably.
Yeah. And can you imagine the disruption it would make in a Sangha community? It would just be really, really so very messy. Ducky.
And even if you showed your powers once, that wouldn't satisfy people. The word would spread and people would say, oh, show it again, show it again, show it again. So
yeah. Yeah, and the need to learn the Dharma would just be left behind. There's also the instruction that we have that if we lie about having powers that we don't have, that's a root offense, and we lose our ordination. It's over. So Venerable Chogyam in His Holiness go on to tell a sutra about the layman Kavada, who asked the Buddha to increase the faith of the lay people by demonstrating his supernormal powers. But the Buddha refused. Kavada then asked him to display his ability to read other people's minds, and the Buddha also declined. Instead, the Buddha showed Kavada another type of miracle. Here, Kavada, a monastic gives instructions as follows. Consider it this way. Don't consider it that way. Direct your mind this way, not that way. Give up this. Give up that. Gain this. Persevere in this. And in other words, the true miracle, again, is being able to instruct others and inspire their faith in the Dharma so that they may feel led away from dukkha and attain nirvana. That is the real miracle. So the Buddha is saying that's the true miracle is being able to give people the kind of instruction so that they can direct their minds to virtue rather than non-virtue. And, you know, the very first time that Geshe Tapge came to the Abbey, he spent a lot of time talking to all of us about who remembers the topic. I don't know what he was invited to teach, but he spent a lot of time on the 10 non-virtues. And he really emphasized over and over again, at least this is how I heard it, that this is your practice right now, the 10 non-virtues. Learning what they are, identifying them in your own mind, learning the antidotes. And, you know, that's really where we should be recognizing where we're at and not asking him to teach us some kind of tantric high practice. So Venerable Chogyam echoes this and she says, the true miracle is being able to instruct others and develop their faith in the Dharma. And this is a rare thing in samsara. It's rare, like miracles are rare. In fact, she says, there's probably more rabbits coming out of hats than people getting instructions on the Dharma. Okay, Venerable Puntsok, we'll start with the slides now. So with that sort of weaving in, we're going to take a look at these six super knowledges. And the first one, slide one, is just the fact that the first five of them are mundane abilities, mundane meaning that you don't have to be an arhat or a Buddha or a highly realized practitioner to have them. And slide two, here's a list of the first five. Supernormal powers, divine ear, understanding the minds of others, recollection of past lives, and the divine eye. Slide three. The sixth super knowledge is a super mundane realization. This is the destruction of the pollutants. So what this means is an Arya knows what afflictions and degree of those afflictions they've been able to abandon completely, not just suppress with concentration, but to abandon. So while non-Buddhists may actualize the first five, because they're mundane, you don't have to be an Arya. Only Buddhists who seek liberation seek the sixth one, the attainment of liberation. The last three super knowledges, recollection of past lives, divine eye, which is the knowledge of passing away and rebirth of beings, and destruction of the pollutants, these three are called the three higher knowledges that the Buddha actualized under the Bodhi tree prior to his awakening. Slide four. In the Pali tradition, sometimes two other powers are added. So these are knowledge and vision. That's one. And then the mind-made body, bringing the total to eight. So in the discourse on the fruits of the homeless life, knowledge and vision is described as follows. The meditator who has attained the fourth dhyana directs and inclines his mind towards knowledge and vision. He knows this is my body. My body is material. It's made up of the four great elements, born of mother and father, fed on rice, gruel, impermanent, liable to be injured and abraded, broken and destroyed. And he also knows, or she, this is my consciousness, which is bound to it and dependent on it. And this is the one of knowledge and vision. So what kind of mental state could come when you really deeply know these? It's the first of the three principal aspects of the path. Renunciation. So if we know these, then we know for sure we're not going to beat around the bush and think it's not going to happen. Aging's going to happen, whether we like it or not. We're going to be injured at some point, abraded, broken, and destroyed. This body is perishable. Any little thing can destroy it. And this is my consciousness, which has so much potential, but it's bound to the body and dependent on this body. And so who is my mind bound to this? Why is this mind bound to the body and dependent on this body? Well, it's due to craving and attachment and clinging. The 8th, 9th links of the 12 links of dependent arising. So in the Sanskrit tradition, it asserts that the first 5 super knowledges can be attained on the basis of the actual first jhana. The Pali tradition says the actual 4th jhana is required because the mind is very pliant and concentration is strong and imperturbable. Slide 5. So the first of the super knowledges is called supernormal powers. Supernormal powers are super knowledges, but not all super knowledges are supernormal powers. So the training for the 5 is rigorous, but when the mind's developed in this way, it's able to have mastery over nature and defy ordinary scientific laws. The Buddha described meditators with such power in this way. Having been one, they become many. Having been many, they become one. They can take one body and out of it manifest many bodies, and you can be in more than one place at the same time. Then the next thing they can do is they can appear and vanish. Then they can go unhindered through walls, through enclosures, through mountains. They dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. They walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. Seated cross-legged, they travel in space like birds. With their hands, they touch and stroke the moon and sun. They wield bodily mastery even as far as the Brahma world. So this one has me really a little bit puzzled, I have to say. The others that are listed make a little bit more sense to me, but I'm wondering if you have thoughts about why this group of powers, how could it be so useful? I mean, they're kind of extraordinary feats that would just dazzle, but I think I'm missing something. Well, I'll tell you what, think about it. And then we'll come back and see if you have some thoughts. So that's the first one, the supernormal powers. Slide 6. This gets really interesting. So this is the other one from the Pali tradition, this man-made body. So supernormal powers allow for the ability to create a man-made body. The dhyanic mind creates another physical body that's an exact replica of the meditator's body with all its limbs and sense faculties. So now you have a twin. But it is a mind-made body. The Buddha described it as like a reed extracted from a sheath, a sword pulled out from a scabbard, or a snake removed from its sloth, its skin. So this body is kind of like, this body is that appearing from the physical body. Once the mind-made body has been extracted from the physical body, the meditator mentally controls it because it has no mind of its own. In other words, it isn't like there's two different people with two different mind streams of consciousness. It's one stream of consciousness that's in the meditator, And the meditator can control the movements and everything in the man-made body. So the meditator mentally controls the man-made body because it has no mind of its own. And even to others, it looks like it's a normal body. It looks like it's moved by its own consciousness. So we may be somewhere and see somebody, and it's actually their man-made body that's talking to us. And we just see this as a regular person. So what's even more interesting is that this man-made body can travel to distant places while the meditator remains at the monastery. It can appear to teach Dharma elsewhere, and when it has served its purpose, the meditator absorbs it back into his own body. So what is really interesting to me is I'm wondering why this is one of the eight. Like, this seems very different from the first one, where you have the supernormal powers and you're emitting all of these Buddha bodies all over the place, like we, you know, in the Shakyamuni Buddha practice, that's part of the first part of the practice, all of these little Buddhas going out in light beams from the pores of the Buddha, going out to do their thing. And then there's this one, which seems, I don't know, maybe this is like the training ground for that power. I couldn't really find much about this in other sources where I looked, but Venerable did mention that Dipa Ma was considered to have this kind of ability. And so in her biography, I couldn't, of course, read it, the whole thing, but it does say this, that in interviews of her students who they interviewed some of her students who actually witnessed her walking on water. They witnessed her diving into the earth and emerging. They saw her skywalking by turning the air element into the earth element to support her weight. They saw her skywalking at tree height level. And then she would go to meditation interviews. What do you mean? What does that say? Wait a minute. Sorry. Something weird there. She would go walking at night in India, and she would create a mind body of herself as a companion to discourage people from bothering her. Now, that is very practical. That would save us a lot of time here if we could do that, driving into Spokane at night. So apparently, a very skeptical professor, of course, arranged a test where Dipa Ma simultaneously with a mind-created body, they keep pointing to this mind-created body, appeared simultaneously in two places at the same time. One place with her teacher, the other with this skeptical professor. So anyway, I find it very interesting that there's this mind-made body that's very different from the supernormal power aspect mentioned earlier. And I guess we'll just see when we get there. I have, of course, no experience with any of this. We're getting it in the form of words tonight. Okay, slide 7. The second super knowledge is the divine ear. It's also called, in different texts, clairaudience. And this is where meditators can hear sounds in the heavenly realm, the human world, and other realms, and all directions where sentient beings dwell. So these meditators can hear sounds, listen to conversations, hear cries of pleasure or pain that are far away as easily as ones nearby. So obviously, if you're practicing the Bodhisattva practice path, it's very helpful to be able to do this because then you can know what questions your students have, what things they don't understand. You can go to teachings yourself through clairaudience. It's very helpful. In the Majjhima Nikaya, it says the divine ear element, which is purified and surpasses the human, they hear both kinds of sounds, the divine and the human, those that are far and those that are near. Slide 8. So the third, The third super knowledge is understanding the minds of others. So the meditators know the way to understand the minds of other beings, having encompassed them with their own minds. So you're able to understand the person's mind. They understand a mind affected by lust as affected by lust, and a mind unaffected by lust as unaffected by lust. They understand a mind affected by hate as unaffected by hate, and mind So they don't make mistakes when they see the other's minds in their cognition about what's going on in people's minds. They understand a mind affected by confusion as affected by confusion, and a mind unaffected by confusion as unaffected by confusion. They understand a contracted mind. So when our mind is contracted and tight and narrow and can't take anything else, they understand this. They understand an exalted mind as exalted. And exalted means generally having perceived emptiness. They understand a surpassed mind is surpassed. They know when our mind is wandering, daydreaming, when our lids are half closed in a review. They can understand anybody who's observing their mind, and they can tell when our mind is virtuous. And they also know that our mind is in states of being unvirtuous. They'll know a mind who's free of samsara and who's not. So His Holiness says in relation to this one, with this super knowledge, meditators know the mental states of others as clearly as they see a spot on their own face reflected in a clear and bright mirror. So, for example, if another person's mind is affected by attachment or anger, they know it as such. So I'm really looking forward to this one. You know, all day long, I look at all of you through all of these lenses of all these mental states that I have, and I'm not seeing you, and you're not seeing me. Well, I can't say what your level is. I'm sorry. I'm not seeing you, and I would really like to see you. I'd really like to understand why you do what you do. Really. I'd like to understand why you say what you say. And, you know, if we knew all that about each other, wouldn't that be beautiful? There would not be a hint of judgment in our mind anymore. We would know why you're doing what you're doing. It's like, of course you would do that. Of course you would move the chair like that. Of course you would say that to me in the way you said it to me. We would know that. And it would just be like, no big deal. It's like, of course. I'm fine with it. I wish you all the well. So... Slide 9. Let's go. So the fourth super knowledge is the recollection of past lives. So the story goes that right before the Buddha attained awakening under the Bodhi tree, he gained three higher knowledges. The three higher knowledges are also the super knowledges. So when he sat there that night, first the Maras came and bothered him. And it looked like external beings coming Adam. It was actually his own attachment and his own hatred banished. And then when he knew that, he was able to banish them. And here's some advice from Venerable Chodron with this one. So she says that given that we've done everything in the past, it's probably a pretty good idea every day to confess, and you've heard her say this many times, confess the disturbing things we are reading and hearing in the news. And even though we can't even remember doing it, we're probably horrified when we read it in the news, like I couldn't have possibly have done that. Well, chances are we did. And it's really good because, you know, if we're getting a reaction to somebody doing something, and you know who, and I'm not going to say, but there's a really good chance we have behaved like that in the past. And so it's very good to do that kind of purification. And then she says, you know, I can see the effects on other people when I look at people whose actions bother me deeply. I see the effects on our whole society, on the whole planet. And she says, I never want to create havoc in the minds of so many people by being that kind of person. So you never know who we've been in the past, and I use that for purification, she says. So there's a quote from the Majjhima Nikaya that says, about this one, the way to recollect their manifold past lives, that is one birth, two births, 100,000 births, and so on, is in this way. Then they know about each of those lives. There I was named, I was so named of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such was my experience of pleasure and pain, such was my lifespan and passing away from there. I reappeared elsewhere, and there too, I was named so-and-so, all those things passing away from there, I reappeared here, and so on. So seeing being born, seeing your name, your family, your social status, your education level, what you did in those lives, how you were regarded, what pleasure and pain you experienced, what pleasure and pain you caused others, and then remembering that you died and then again got reborn another birth. So thus, with their aspects and particulars, they recollect their manifold past lives. And so with that kind of super knowledge, I don't know. It's certainly not something that I could handle with my ordinary mind, seeing that kind of level of detail, going back and back and back and seeing what I did, how I caused others pain. I think that would be just, you'd have to have the mind of an arhat or, you know, a pure level bodhisattva, I think, to handle that kind of information. But having that kind of information too, Venerable says, it can really inspire your Dharma practice. And because by that point, when you see all this, you really don't want to be in samsara anymore. There's no question about that. And that would just continue to guide you on the path. Slide 10. So this is interesting because now His Holiness and Venerable Children are talking about how to develop this particular super knowledge. So in the Path of Purification by Buddhaghosa, he says, to develop this ability, a meditator must first master the dhyanas up to the fourth dhyana. So first you have to do that. So you're bringing your mind to imperturbability. You have serenity, which permeates all those meditative absorptions. And because the dhyanas are states of single-pointed concentration on one object, remembering previous lives, which involves turning the mind to many objects, can't be done while you're in the fourth dhyana itself. So you have to have attained the fourth dhyana, but then you have to come out of it, and with the mind that's not in that dhyana state, but having the carryover feeling of that, then you use your mind to start remembering back and back and back. Because the dhyanas are states of single-pointed concentration on one object, and remembering previous lives, which involves turning the mind to many objects, thinking about each life and what happened, that can't be done in that fourth dhyana. So meditators emerge from the fourth dhyana in a state of ordinary consciousness, where the mind is still suffused with that power and clarity of the dhyana. So when they talk about coming out of different concentrations and meditative states, when you come out, the power of that concentration is still with you. It's suffusing your mind. Meditators emerge from the fourth dhyana. Yeah, okay. I said that already. Sorry. They remember what happened before and gradually extending their memory as far back as possible to events from childhood and infancy. And then remembering far back to being 1-year-old, being in the womb. And then each time they hit a wall, they have to go back into the fourth dhyana and get more clarity. Slide 11. So whenever their memory becomes cloudy, they pause and they enter the fourth dhyana. They get refreshed in that. They strengthen it. They purify their mind. So that's the effect of the concentration, to refresh, strengthen, and purify the mind, so that when they start looking back in time again, the mind is clear and can see things. Re-emerging again from the dhyana, they take up recollecting events in their lives from where they left off, going back to the time of birth, life in the womb, up to the time of conception, and then when the consciousness first entered the union of egg and sperm of this life. At this time, they get to the time when the consciousness first entered the union of egg and sperm, and they're going back and back, and then they come up against a wall, and they can't remember anything more. But without giving up at that point, they then re-enter the fourth dhyana, refresh the mind, make it focused and sharp. And emerging from that, again, they try to recall what happened in the moment before birth, the moment before conception. So this is the process they go on. They get a certain distance, they hit kind of like a wall, they refresh that mind with the fourth dhyana, and they keep going back and back and back. And so they continue with this practice, developing the ability to remember vividly thousands, if not millions or billions of previous lives. Whew. Okay. Slide 12. The fifth super knowledge is called divine eye or clairvoyance. And this one gives meditators access to the death and rebirth of sentient beings. So in the previous super knowledge, we were remembering the lives of our own. Now we're knowing the lives of other sentient beings, their death and rebirth, who they were born as, when they died. In many ways, this would be actually very helpful for us to realize emptiness in the sense that you can remember all of these lifetimes. And then you realize that all these people that you're remembering their lifetimes about, they're just karmic bubbles. There's no real person there going from one life to the next. Again, in the Majjhima Nikaya, it says about the divine eye. This is purified, of course, and surpasses the human. They see beings passing away and reappearing, inferior and superior, like in terms of knowledge, social class, health, those things fair and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. They understand how beings pass on according to their actions. These worthy ones who were ill-conducted in body, speech, and mind, revilers of Aryas, wrong in their views, giving effect to wrong view in their actions, on the dissolution of the body after death, they've reappeared in a state of deprivation, in a bad destination. So what would it be like to have that capacity? Yeah, Venerable Chuni said freaky. It would be actually horrifying with an ordinary mind. I just couldn't handle it, I don't think. I couldn't. Slide 13. See, the other thing about this and, you know, the mind that has attained that state is able to handle it. They're seeing all these beings dying and reappearing in their next life according to their karma. And then no matter how much we care for these people, we're looking at people we see and know. No matter, you know, if we like them or dislike them, they're getting reborn according to their karma. So, you know, the people that we're deeply attached to, the people we care about, we see where they're headed based on their karma, and there's nothing we can do about it. So, people who have attained this understand clearly how sentient beings are governed and controlled by their karma. And if we had that kind of capacity right now, what do you think that would do about our conviction in the belief of karma? I think it's kind of obvious. And how would it change how we live if we had this kind of conviction? I think it would be really potent medicine, where we can not just talk about karma and its effects, but actually live it. So as Venerable says, if you really believe that your actions have an ethical dimension and are going to cause your happiness and suffering, then you're going to make very different choices. So the beings with this kind of ability, they are able to see events in other realms in the universe, in places far away and in other dimensions. And then with a divine eye, you see different realms. You can see spirits and nagas and devas and beings in the Brahma realm. And she says, for a Dharma teacher, this ability is especially useful because then you would know which various sentient beings you had karma with. You would know their unique dispositions and how to skillfully benefit them. And there are apparently many stories in the sutras of the Buddha knowing by means of his divine eye which beings were receptive to the Dharma at a certain time and whose faculties were ripe to gain realizations if they were taught. And so when the Buddha went before any audience, he would know the karma of all the people sitting in front of him, where somebody was in their life and what they needed to hear. And by knowing which beings in other realms or other universes are ripe to be led in the Dharma, bodhisattvas with these supernormal powers can go to those places to teach them. Now that's very cool. So if you have the divine eye and you see somebody in another universe who has the karma to gain a certain kind of understanding, and you can see that you have a karmic link with that person from previous lives, then if you have supernormal powers, then you can zip over to whatever realm they're in. I think somebody zipped over to this realm and got our attention. I think so. So if you have great compassion for sentient beings, and this gives all of us, if we have that, the ability to benefit a lot of people. So there's many stories in the sutras of the Buddha knowing by means of his divine eye which beings were receptive and so on. And by knowing which ones were receptive in even other realms, other universes, bodhisattvas with those supernormal powers can go and teach them. And they do it with the divine eye, which is attained by the light kasina. So then they go on to explain, sometimes while extending light further and further, as they use their divine eye, the mind becomes dull and the light can't penetrate to reveal those realms and events. And at that time, the meditators again cultivate concentration with the light kasina and use that to enter the fourth dhyana. And when their mind is refreshed again and clear, they emerge from that dhyana and they resume radiating the light. Eventually, this powerful samadhi can illuminate other realms that are ordinarily concealed, and meditators can see devas, hungry ghosts, hell beings, as well as human beings and animals in other parts of the universe. Fixing their attention on particular beings, they inquire mentally, what is the karma that brought this being to be born in this realm of existence? And by the power of the divine eye, they gain direct understanding of this karma. They can see that those beings in the unfortunate realms were born there owing to the power of specific destructive actions, and that those unfortunate realms, that those in those unfortunate realms attain such rebirths due to the actions they committed. Slide 14. So now the sixth superknowledge is destruction of the pollutants. So the Majjhima Nikaya says, by realizing for themselves with direct knowledge, they here and now enter upon and abide in the liberation of mind and liberation by wisdom that are unpolluted with the destruction of the pollutants. So when you've attained this, you know exactly what you've abandoned. So Shravakas, Arhats, and Bodhisattvas of the pure grounds know the abandonment of the afflictive obscurations. And in the mind stream of Buddhas, they know their abandonment of both the afflictive and the cognitive obscurations. Does anyone have any comments about these six superknowledges? Okay, I'm going to read you another story from Footprints in the Dust before we do kind of like a review of those six by looking at the value of them. This is again from Footprints in the Dust. So there was a naked ascetic named, I'm not going to do this word very well. We'll just call him P, who had a reputation for possessing miraculous powers and received generous patronage because of it. And one day he threw down this challenge at an assembly at Vasali, and he said, the Samana Gautama claims to be a man of wisdom, and I make this same claim. It is only right the man of wisdom should prove it by performing a psychic wonder. If he comes halfway, I will come the other half, and having met, we can both perform a wonder. If he performs one, I will perform two. If he performs two, I'll perform four. And if he performs four, I'll perform eight. No matter how many psychic wonders the Samana Gautama performs, I will perform double that. Well, in the end, this ascetic actually failed up to turn up at the appointed time, and nothing came of his challenge. So the moral of this story is the Buddhist tradition has long pointed out that miraculous powers should not be taken as evidence of spiritual or even moral accomplishments. As far as the Buddha was concerned, miracles were one thing, and the Dharma was something else entirely. He said, whatever superhuman qualities, abilities, psychic feats, or miracles are performed or not, my purpose in teaching the Dharma is to lead whoever practices it to the complete freedom of suffering. In which case, what's the point of performing miracles? Did I cover your story that you were going to share?
No, I had the one that
you okay. said. Well, I'll tell you what, just to keep people awake, because I know this is hard, there's a lot of talking. How about if we do it in a few minutes? So let's go to slide 15. So now we're going to do an overview of these six again, with the focus of the value of these super knowledges. So with supernormal powers, bodhisattvas go to Pure Lands, where they listen to Dharma teachings directly from various Buddhas. In Pure Lands, they create enormous merit by emanating abundant, magnificent offerings that they offer to the Buddhas and bodhisattvas there. Doesn't that sound great? Like, let's go there. Let's get that one. Slide 16. In the human realm, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas benefit others by revealing these powers to specific disciples to enhance their faith and joyous effort. That's all. And they do it discreetly with no wish to gain reputation or fame. Buddhas and Bodhisattvas can also manifest many bodies, appearing as ordinary individuals in diverse places to teach and guide the beings there. In addition, these miraculous abilities enable Bodhisattvas to know where their spiritual mentors, Dharma friends, and disciples with whom they have karmic connections are living, and they go there quickly to either receive or give teachings and guidance. Slide 17. So with a divine ear, bodhisattvas can hear teachings in other places and understand all languages. Wow, that would save us so much time and money with this audiovisual problem that we have when we do multiple language things. This enables them to understand a wide range of teachings and know their students, Dharma discussions, and so on. With this knowledge, bodhisattvas have the ability to resolve their students' doubts and dispel their misconceptions. Through knowledge of others' minds, bodhisattvas directly know others' interests and dispositions, as well as their emotional patterns and habitual thoughts, and thus can teach them accordingly. They know whose mind is under the influence of afflictions and who is free from afflictions. Cherishing others more than themselves, bodhisattvas are never judgmental. When they see that someone's mind is overcome with afflictions, instead, their compassion and determination to help that person increases. Okay, Venerable Semkhe, what do you have from that book, Footprints in the Dust?
It's just Buddha going after one of the monks who goes ahead and wants to use his power to become famous.
Great.
It's coming from the same section that Ben was talking about. Okay. On another occasion.
On another occasion, a wealthy merchant had a valuable sandalwood bowl placed on the top of a bamboo pole, which was then erected in the center of the town. He then had a proclamation made to the effect that anyone who could rise to the top of the bowl through psychic power could have the bowl. The monk Pindola heard of this, and having manifested the ability to levitate, he took up the challenge and retrieved the bowl. When the Buddha came to know of this, he rebuked the monk in the strongest terms. "You are like a prostitute who lifts her skirt for the sake of a miserable coin." Then he made it an offense for monks or nuns to display any psychic abilities they might develop. What happened subsequent to Pindola's spectacular demonstration helps to explain the Buddha's reaction to it. Noisy, excited crowds began following Pindola around. The Buddha wanted people to respect him and his monks and nuns because of their virtue and wisdom, not because they were mesmerized by what they took to be unusual or miraculous powers.
Thank you very much, Semkhe. I actually did read that, and I was going to put it into the talk, but then I was too embarrassed by that one section. I thought, I actually can't read that part out loud, so.
Well, it says in the strongest terms, right?
Terms. Yeah, some people are cowards and some people aren't. Thank you. Okay, slide 18. Knowing past lives, what are the virtues of this? So bodhisattvas know their spiritual mentors, Dharma practices, and spiritual friends from previous lives, and thus seek them out again in this life. Isn't that going to be fun? I saw you way back in 2026 at the Srivasti Abhi. Remember when we did that? Remember we did this? Studying and practicing under the guidance of teachers with whom they have associated with and whom they have deep trust and faith from previous lives, and continuing practices in which they've already trained in previous lives enables them to progress rapidly. This explains a lot about someone that we know. In addition, they know the disciples with whom they've had Dharma connections in previous lives and continue to guide and teach them. By clearly seeing the karma that their disciples have created in the past, these bodhisattvas understand their disciples' present experiences and tendencies and know how to guide them effectively. Then, slide 19, the divine eye. So this allows bodhisattvas to know others' karmic tendencies as well as where they have been reborn. They also know the karmic results of actions that people are doing now, which helps them to guide their disciples more effectively. Clairvoyance gives bodhisattvas the ability to discern sentient beings' karmic receptivity to the Dharma and to interact with them accordingly. It also enables them to locate their previous disciples and benefit them in their present life forms. Understanding others' minds, bodhisattvas know who has entered the path and their level of realization, as well as who has not entered the path, and they can guard them accordingly. And I would imagine this one, too, if you've got the divine eye, if you're giving a teaching and people are on their devices, and you see that they're going to their calendar or they're doing the safe course facilitating during the teaching, or they're looking up, what is divine eye again? Or maybe they're going to look up, what is the meaning of miracle? Or what is she talking about? Or maybe I'm going to see what the weather's going to be like tomorrow. They would know what's going on with everyone's laptop or iPad. I'm sure our teachers know this. What's that? I think they do. Yes. So, very beautiful power to have. Okay, guess what? We're at the last slide. Can you believe it? You're still hanging in there. So, this is the sixth one. It's not mundane. It's super mundane. We can look forward to this after we get those five. So, bodhisattvas of the pure grounds know their own level of spiritual attainment, fortifying their confidence in their ability to benefit others. Arhats know the abandonment of the afflictive obscurations. So even though we're a very long way from these super knowledges, I think just knowing that this capacity of the mind exists and what our potential is very inspiring. And, you know, for example, we don't really know where we're at right now in our spiritual attainment. I don't think. I think Venerable Children knows. But, you know, this idea of cultivating some humility about where we are at. I'm just talking to myself right now. I'm an ordinary sentient being. Okay, so I'm ordained. But, you know, I'm still very much a beginner. And when I hear someone, you know, talking about a situation coming up for them, I'm now really making it a practice of mine to think, you know, something is coming to mind right now to say to this person, but am I really the best person to say this to this person? At least I have some amount of awareness there. And then I might say something, but then I'm more frequently stopping myself and I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to suggest to this person when it's the right time that maybe they go and have a word with Venerable Kadro, or maybe they have a word with, you know, Venerable Children when she's here. And, you know, there are some things we can absolutely help with, but I think really knowing that, you know, our level is where we're at, where I'm at, is a way of cultivating humility. And eventually we'll have the kind of wisdom that our teachers have and that we can be of, you know, benefit when people are making comments. We have some capacity now to do that. So if you can stand a little bit more reading, I'm going to close this review with something from Geshe Sopa from volume 4. And I find this very, very wise words. So he says, "The union of shamatha and vipassana is the true antidote to all your suffering and problems. It is the foundation for achieving liberation from samsara. Another benefit derived from the cultivation of shamatha is supernormal powers that facilitate your ability to help other sentient beings. Usually we speak of five common or mundane supernormal powers or knowledges that result from shamatha. And these include miraculous acts, the divine eye, clairaudience, the knowledge of others' thoughts, recollection of former states, and knowledge of death and rebirth. Miraculous acts are feats, like the ability to turn one body into many, to transform large into small, to fly, to dive into the ground, and to walk on water. These knowledges and powers result from the shamatha practice that is common to Buddhists and non-Buddhists. Even though none of these powers are essential for the attainment of awakening, bodhisattvas can use these abilities to work for the benefit of all sentient beings. However, here's the clincher sentence. You ready? If a practitioner attains these powers, but does not have love, compassion, and the realization of emptiness, they may engage in strange activities that have interesting or even harmful results. These five powers may be common, but they are extremely useful for bodhisattvas who want to attain the goal of perfect awakening for the benefit of all. So that's what I have for tonight. I'm 9 minutes short of the closing time, but I see that it was a lot of talking. So does anyone have any comments or questions? Well, actually, save your questions for Venerable Children for 2 weeks from now. Any comments about this material or what it has brought to mind for anyone? No, SMK?
If you ever get a chance to read Lama Yeshe's biography, Big Love, over and over again, his students say that he had an uncanny ability to be in more than one place at the same time. You know, whether he was up at the hill talking at Koh Phan, maybe escaping, trying to get away down to Kathmandu, and they'd find him in the market somewhere, or they'd be driving as a bus driver in the middle of the night across some town somewhere, he'd be on the side of the road, or he'd be someplace in the, he'd be up in Koh Phan, and they'd be in a garden somewhere, and he'd just come around the corner. And his skillful means, not just that way, but also being able to know his students' dispositions and directing them to do things that at the beginning sounded like something that was really kind of odd, but it turned out to be one of the most incredible learnings and teachings and times of growth for them. So he had whatever capacity he had, there are continually statements in this biography of some of the skillful means that he had that looked like some of these super knowledges for, I don't know, he was a bodhisattva, you know, for sure, but, and all to be able to benefit. His love for them was so adamant and so clear by the way that he would do these things to sort of shake them up or pull the rug out from underneath them when their ego is getting a little bit too out of hand. It's really remarkable eyewitness accounts of this stuff.
Thank you, Venerable Semke. Those are volumes I have to read. I will read. Venerable Kepelge.
What came to my mind was that the Buddha's compassion, that he used all the different super knowledges, power to try to benefit sentient beings, because even though he has all these super knowledge powers, he cannot change our karma. So he has to think of different ways to help us so that we can, you know, change our karma to a virtuous one, to be just like him. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Jake May.
One of the things that came into my mind was that since we don't know what our teachers have attained, but we do know how many years they've studied and how wise they are. So when our teachers ask us to do something, I always think that they know more than I know about the benefit of this for me. And so then I do it, even if I have great resistance, because they see more than I can see, for sure.
Thanks, Venerable Jigme. And to be open to our teacher's advice. Venerable Damjo.
I'm going back to your question about the first supernormal powers. I was just thinking, I read this in the biography of Jitsun Milarepa, that I think a lot of the early translators or people who needed to get copies of scriptures went by, quote, flying feet. That was the translation. So that was one way to go and get scriptures in a time where there were no planes. I mean, to benefit people. But I often think, you know, we have something equivalent to clairaudience or whatever with the internet now, but without any wisdom, we don't use it wisely, right? And instead, it makes us almost not treasure the teachings. Yeah, what I loved about those people with flying feet was not that they had flying feet. Many of them died to go and get scriptures. Yeah, and you're like, wow, this is what they went through to try and learn the Dharma. And then today, you just like click, click, click. And you're like, whatever. Click on whatever, you know? So it's a bit scary.
Yeah, and just to see that we're as fascinated as ever with supernormal miracle kinds of things, you know, and this can be achieved now easily with the use of AI. We don't even know anymore, unless you have AI experience, what's real, what we're looking at. And that, we can be really easily misled, or we can mislead others quite easily with the use of the internet. Venerable Trini, you looked like you were going to say something.
No, that was a sad thing you just said.
Sorry. It's so true.
Yeah. But what is very interesting to me is that even though, and these are Venerable Trojan's works, people were bugging the Buddha all the time. Show your powers. Prove it. Prove it to us that you can, you know, do this and do this and do this. Often he refused. But there's also many examples, as we can see, where he actually did do it because he knew with his supernormal powers and super knowledges that doing this particular thing at that particular time for that group of people would be of benefit to them. And he wasn't looking for the adoration or the fame or being the influencer or any of that. He knew what they needed. So that is just incredible. So may we... now I've got her talking.
Well, I was just thinking about the Buddha Hall.
Oh.
And the funding of the Buddha Hall. And, you know, all the parts of it. I mean, I was just thinking of, like, so there's a lot of miraculous stories around building this building. Some, anyway. And there's also some big, difficult stories around building this building. So the part of the question is, I guess, I don't know what I was thinking, but something about, I mean, clearly, if I analyze that and try to remember that this is so, because it's so easy to forget and just get into mundane thinking, the causes and conditions that come together to make things happen. Also, the enlightening influence of the Buddhas is present. So, just looking at the intentionality of those people with those powers, how much of it is intentional? How much of it is on the scale of becoming more and more like Buddha, who responds spontaneously, and that the condition is already present? You get what I mean? So they're not intentionally saying, I will walk on water. They're saying, oh, there's a dog over there, and they go get the dog, and they just happen to be able to walk on water. But it's not like, you know, the performance part is intentional. But I'm imagining that the application in daily life practice for advanced bodhisattva anyway is pretty spontaneous.
Yeah, good point.
And we can see this in just usual life, even with mothers. There's those stories about the kid is under the car and it rolls and it's the kid stuck under there and the mother comes and she lifts that up. What is driving that? Love and compassion. And it's superhuman, really.
Mm-hmm.
There's many stories about that, getting the mm-hmm. tree trunk off the leg, mm-hmm. the boulder off the arm, all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
Love and compassion.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the Buddha hall for a minute, often, actually daily, I'll be sitting in one of the rooms and I'll think to myself this question, which seems absurd because I saw it from square one. How did this happen? How did this happen? And then I go back and I go through the building process. And it wasn't just the building process. It's the influence of all of these holy beings too. And all of these people showing up to do their job. And all of them really wanting to do this job really well. And of course, there were so many challenges. But it is, going back to what Robert said, it's a miracle. And there's so many things we don't understand about how this all came together beyond just the building of the buildings here. So it's just something to reflect on and to rejoice in that we're part of, and we don't understand all of it. And guess what? In time, we will. So let's have a good time getting there. Thank you, everybody.